Support for 51% comes from Berkshire Co-op Market, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, a community-owned natural grocery store dedicated to sustainable agriculture, the local economy, and the environment, working within the community to better Berkshire County one basket at a time. Berkshire.coop.
On this week's 51%, we hear what the actress playing Albert Einstein's first wife in a National Geographic series thinks about the woman she portrays.
I think she's a really inspirational role model, and I would have benefited from knowing about her when I was a young woman and even now.
We meet a woman who's out to change the plight of honeybees and tune into what a few high school girls have to say about pressure. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Albert Einstein and the people around him, many of whom shaped science history, are getting a fresh look on the new National Geographic series, Genius. The new show, which premiered in April, jumps back and forth in time, focusing on the physicist's early school days and young adulthood, and his middle-age experiences fleeing Germany. Samantha Colley plays the brilliant Mileva Maric, who would become Einstein's first wife. She also has appeared on stage and in the series Victoria, and she spoke with 51%'s Ian Pickus.
What attracted you to this role?
Oh, all sorts. Mileva Maric is a feminist icon, in my opinion, that's kind of sat there in history that no one knows about. I was very attracted to the idea of shedding light on someone that I truly believe deserves recognition and respect that didn't get it in her lifetime. And the thought of, you know, that happening for her now makes me feel really happy.
How familiar were you with her story before all this?
I did not know about Mileva Maric at all. In fact, when I asked to audition for the role, I believed that they had kind of written a love interest for Albert Einstein. So when I found she was a real woman, I felt really hard done by, actually, and quite aghast. I didn't know that she existed because, as I say, I think she's a really inspirational role model, and I would have benefited from knowing about her when I was a young woman and even now. She's a real example of not taking no for an answer, and her life was all about being taken as an equal, as a man, and she rose through the ranks of education at a time when it was pretty impossible for women, and was an amazing physicist and mathematician in her own right. And so it's very sad that she's just known as Albert's first wife, really.
What kind of research did you do, and what materials were available as you were researching the character?
I focused on the letters between Albert Einstein and Mileva Maric, and also between Mileva Maric and her best friend, Helena Savage. And they were a gold mine. As I say, when you Google Mileva, you see these black and white images of this very rigid woman, you know, sat in a chair with a bit of a stern look on her face, and you think she's this very impenetrable person. And actually, the letters revealed her to be this deeply loving, warm, supportive, funny, witty, extremely sensitive woman who was riddled with self-doubt. And her vulnerability and the dichotomy of that, the dichotomy of her being very strong and armored in her outward persona, and this kind of melting vulnerability inside, was fascinating for me to learn about. And also to learn about the relationship between young Albert Einstein and young Mileva. I think the world thinks they know, you know, this father of physics and this the icon on the pedestal, really. But no one really knows that Albert Einstein started out as a young, curious man who was questioning this inherited wisdom, and everyone found that quite annoying and was telling him to shut up and stop it. And Mileva Maric was the person that told him, no, that's what we're here to do. We're here to question, and that's attractive, and go and question. I'll be here right with you questioning as well. And I loved learning about the origins of his genius, and you know, where that all started. And I think that's one of the triumphs of the show.
One very interesting thing about it is it sort of blows up the notion of Einstein as the middle-aged guy with the crazy hair, because you see him young, as played by your co-star Johnny Flynn. What was it like working with him as the young Einstein and the young Mileva?
It was brilliant working with Johnny. Again, it was very important for me to do right by Mileva, and it was very important for Johnny to do right by Albert. And we really hit it off, and we really came together with that kind of respect and importance in mind. And it was brilliant. As I say, we were bringing to life these two young people who were fiercely intelligent, but also fiercely passionate. And it was amazing to come together and bring them to life.
Light is electromagnetic radiation.
I apologize. I didn't think that...
the woman could possibly understand that the curl of the electric field is equal to the negative time derivative of the magnetic field.
Faraday's law.
The Maxwell-Faraday equation, if we are being specific.
Now, part of your character deals with like physical frailties. I think if I saw this right, when your character makes her entrance, the camera sort of pans to her feet and she's got some physical infirmities. So how did you bring that aspect of the character to life?
Again, I approached that wanting to be as respectful as possible. Mileva was born with a congenital hip misalignment, which meant she had quite a substantial limp. And yes, that what you see is Mileva's orthopedic boot, which tries to level out some of the discrepancy in one of her legs. And again, the letters reveal that she used to kind of limp along. Helena Savage, Mileva's best friend, the granddaughter of her best friend, wrote something about Mileva, that she was this kind of scary figure when she was a young girl. And she remembers going on a walk along a river, and Mileva was there lumbering along, and she used to wear these long skirts trying to hide her boot. And Albert Einstein's mother was actually quite unfair to Mileva. She used to call her a witch and hop along and this... you know, this kind of ogre of a woman, which she wasn't really. She was just, she was a bit different. And she overcame that, which again, and she didn't let it limit her, much like she didn't let her femininity and her gender impinge on her and what she believed was her ability to be an amazing scientist. The only thing that did stop her was society and everything that happens. I don't want to give it away, but it's a sad story.
Yes, please don't. is there more pressure on you as an actor when you are playing a historical figure as compared to a fictional character?
I'd say I really fell in love with Mileva, and I fell in love with her as a, you know, as a human being. And so I'd say the extra added thing is the responsibility I felt of doing right by someone that, again, I felt was kind of chewed up and spat out by history. And again, in her letters, she didn't believe she was lovable, and she, you know, she was preoccupied with that idea. And to know that she kind of that I could be doing something to perhaps make people regard her in a nice way was a, you know, a real privilege, but a real pressure. And I hope I've done that. I hope people and watch the show and, you know, think that she's a great person, because she really was.
What's it like to, you know, to go on a set where everything is set more than 100 years before?
It's great, but I think one of the things I notice is that they have the same problems we do. And, you know, just because they don't have iPhones and you know, products from Apple doesn't mean that they're any different to us. And I love that. I love that about period work, is that it's this unifying feeling that we get, where the, you know, the struggles of the human existence are always going to be present, and they're always going to be there. And yeah, it's beautiful. I do love that. I've never actually worked in my own accent or in anything in my own time period, so I look forward to doing that in the future.
What was the accent that you attempted to do in the show? It's one of those things where obviously it's in English, right? But people are speaking in I don't know, a European way, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, I think Mileva Marić is Serbian, so that's the accent I'm trying to do. And everyone else is German. Well, not everyone else, but yeah, mostly German. That's the funny thing between Johnny and I. When we first started together, I'd pick up his German and he'd pick up my Serbian. But our accents coach kind of kept us on the straight and narrow. hopefully.
That was Samantha Colley speaking with 51%'s Ian Pickus. She appears on the National Geographic series Genius about the life of Albert Einstein. The 10-part series premiered in April. Between a changing climate and an invasion of parasites, it's a tough time for the honeybee. A Norfolk, Virginia woman's quest to give bees a home may yield valuable research on their plight. She's putting bee backpacks in the hands of local kids. John Last has the story.
You may hear a little cracking because they will seal this hive close.
It's the first warm day of spring. I'm standing in a vegetable garden in Calvert Square, a Norfolk housing project. Kids from the local preschool are playing behind me, and I'm watching Carrie Brown break into a beehive.
There we go. Oh, okay. You're going to get some buzz. That'll be good.
Carrie is a retention advisor at Norfolk State University, but she's here today in her other role as Norfolk's Honeybee Brown, defender of the bees.
How I got started in beekeeping is through my niece. Her neighbor had a hive. And
Brown has been beekeeping since 2009. When she started, it was as a summer project she could share with her niece. But her passion project soon took on a much wider significance.
When I first started beekeeping, it was about the honey. And then as I learned more about the honeybee and their plight, my mission is just to save them now.
Bees are dying off in alarming numbers. Dropping winter temperatures are killing entire hives, while parasites and insecticides are affecting whole geographic regions. But Brown says as fragile as the honeybee is, they're a key part of our food chain. And she's not just talking about honey.
The bees are responsible for 3 out of every 5 bites of food that we take.
Brown gets to see this in action at her apiary.
We got some kale and some cilantros. There's collard greens.
That's Julius Norman. He's the youth programs manager at the Norfolk Redevelopment and Housing Authority and the man behind the Daisy Riddick Community Garden at Calvert Square. It's where Brown's bees have their home.
For me, it's healthy lifestyles, getting people healthy.
When Norman talks about healthy lifestyles, he's not just talking about food. Getting people healthy at Calvert Square involves employing and inspiring them as much as it does feeding them. When it came time to make his garden, Norman hired local kids to design and build irrigation systems, hoping to inspire a love of engineering. Now that food is growing, the garden's vegetables are given away to local seniors or used in the center's classes on healthy cooking.
And I would like to think that it's the bees that make our watermelon, cantaloupe, and everything taste so good.
But the bees aren't only there for food. Brown has plans to join an innovative new research initiative tracking the movements of honeybees. Using tiny sensors from Intel placed on honeybees' backs, researchers have been tracking where they forage for pollen, how far they travel, and which crops, plants, and gardens they sustain on their trips. What Brown is talking about doing is putting some of the most advanced technology in entomology, the study of insects, into the hands of kids.
You know, it's high-tech research. That's how the brightest and the best are doing it. But I used to be an elementary school teacher, and I thought, you know, we could teach children to do this and present it as a game.
Kids will be able to choose their honeybee and track its movements between pollinator gardens Brown has built up in the neighborhood. The goal? To create a new generation of entomologists, a job Brown says she wishes she knew about sooner.
If I had 40, 60, 80 more years left, and maybe if I had known about just the field of entomology when I was a child, probably would have majored in entomology and made the bees my life's work.
Back at the hive, and the stakes are high. It's Brown's first look inside since before the winter months. With the sun just peeking around the corner, the bees were not yet fully awake. Could a parasite or a temperature drop have disrupted the hive? When Brown looks inside, she's ecstatic.
Not only that, I was so happy to see so much honey. They are doing well, and they're safe here. There's nothing's going to bother them.
For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm John Last.
Pressures for high school students vary depending on their grade level and gender. And we'll hear a bit about those pressures as we zoom into one high school outside Buffalo, New York. WBFO's senior reporter Eileen Buckley met with four girls from Lakeshore Central High School in Angola and chatted with them about various topics, including time spent on social media.
Four high school teenage girls gathered at two round cafeteria tables, discussing their school life.
I actually had a great 4 years, but I'm ready to actually leave. I'm ready for college.
Senior Leah Mosier kicked off our conversation. She's anxious to complete high school and graduate this June. But Mosier's generation has a big distraction, online living.
So it's kind of an issue because that's all you pay attention to is social media. So when you're in school, a lot of people will go on Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat. It's hard to pay attention sometimes. People talk about other people on social media, so like that also affects people's lives in school, which is really hard for them, so I feel bad for that.
So it's distracting.
It's like a distraction, yeah.
Mosier tries to avoid girl drama, but says she does witness cyberbullying. She tells us too many students just say what's on their mind without thinking about hurting others' feelings. The teen finds completing schoolwork and homework, preparing for tests, and getting along with students and teachers all a major challenge for many students.
Just being able to come to school in the morning. Some people have things going on in their life that you don't know about, so when they come to school and they're in a bad mood, you can't really tell them to stop because you don't know exactly what's going on in their life.
Trying to grow up and you're trying to realize what's important, and you have to focus more on school and getting into colleges now and think about what you want to do with your life.
Lakeshore High School junior Dylan Gartley describing pressure of being a teenager.
What about behaviors and student behaviors? Does it affect you in your life?
Yeah, I feel like some people have trouble growing up, and they can definitely affect other people and like the atmosphere being in the classroom and trying to learn while other people don't really care about that. And that goes along with like social media and stuff, how everybody's on it all the time.
There is so much social media. It's just hooked into your whole lives, isn't it?
Yeah, I feel like no matter what, everybody is part of it.
Do you see cyberbullying with each other? Have you been a victim of it?
Never personally been a victim of it, but yeah, I see it a lot, especially on like Twitter. So if everybody's doing something to somebody else.
For a second-year high school student, maintaining friendships is a major challenge. Rebecca Perry tells us balancing her social life, school life, and schedule as a student-athlete has become very difficult.
Well, I don't get home until about like 5:30 every night because I run cross-country and track. And so as soon as I get home, I try to do my homework and study and everything, but a lot of times I tend to get distracted by my phone. So it's really difficult. A lot of times I don't go to bed until around midnight, so I barely get any sleep too. So,
what's happening on your phone? What are you doing? Social media?
Yeah, looking at Twitter and Instagram.
Is it to the point of you know you should just put the phone down and walk away?
Yeah, honestly, I'd say I'm not on my phone as much as my friends, but I definitely do try to take part in it because everyone like in our school does, and I feel like I'm missing out if I'm not. I've seen a lot of times people are put down online or people's appearances are made fun of.
That's Matea Riley, a junior at Lakeshore.
I fear for their self-esteem because what bullying does to your self-esteem makes it almost like hard to recover in your life because this is such an important stage of our lives that when your self-esteem is damaged like that when you're this age, it can carry on to when you're an adult.
Do you see it as kind of a destructive factor in their life?
I see it as definitely very destructive because it's hard to figure out what you want your purpose to be professionally and otherwise when you don't really know who you are because you're too busy trying to follow trends or trying to be like someone that you're not.
Riley says she tries to stay off social media, taking breaks from her phone. This frees her up to do things she enjoys, like writing poetry, short stories, and reading.
What about time management for you? How do you deal with that as a teen?
It's pretty hard to deal with time management because it's getting harder and harder to stand out to colleges because of, you know, so many other accomplishments that are occurring. And so you really have to pack your schedule and become busy so that colleges will see you as an outstanding student.
This piece was from WBFO's Eileen Buckley. We now bring you Dr. Sharon Ufberg with her 51% segment, Force of Nature. And even though Mother's Day has come and gone, really, is it just one day? Ufberg shares what came to the surface as she honored her mother.
My mother died before I ever married, had children of my own, finished graduate school, or launched my own career. She was battling a terminal illness before I even had my driver's license. But what I remember about her character and her strength is still very vivid. We had opposite personalities, and at first glance appeared to have nothing in common. I was profoundly extroverted, high energy, and light-hearted. No, downright silly, to her quiet and more serious nature. So, I'm acknowledging the five exceptional qualities that my mother shared with me. Number one, fearlessness. My mom was the first person I ever knew who had breast cancer. When she returned home after her mastectomy, instead of hiding her physical wounds, she openly wanted to show me her incision. It was important for her to share with me her teenage daughter, how well she was healing, and to actively confront my fears about her health. She did this without words, but with actions. She did not shy away from her fate, but instead fought openly and fearlessly to stay alive. Number two, dogged determination. While my father was the professional and the clear breadwinner of the family, my mother was still persistent in her desire to contribute to the family's financial matters. I remember how she always kept her small blue savings book on the shelf in her bedroom closet. She would bring it down and show me how much she had saved each month working part-time as a substitute teacher. She was determined to pay at least one semester of my private school tuition each year and was so proud when she managed to save enough to contribute to my education. Now I realize that she could have spent her hard-earned money indulging herself with another pair of great shoes. She loved shoes. Or a weekend away with my father. But instead, she spent it all on me. I'm not sure I even ever thanked her. She taught me once again by example that I could achieve most anything once I was determined to do so. Number three, unconditional love. This is hands down the most incredible gift she gave me. There was nothing my mother would not do for her family, especially her own children. She had endless patience to watch my 1,000 leaps off the diving board at the pool all summer and never seemed distracted when I wanted to talk to her about my worries, hopes, or dreams. She always said, "Sharon, you can be anything you want to be," and she made me believe it. But the most amazing part about her unconditional love and support was that there was no strings attached, no obligation or need to give anything back in return. It was just motherly love and unconditional support. I was unaware until much later in life that this was a precious gift she gave to me, a gift few others I knew had the luxury of experiencing. She made me a much better mother because of her ability to love so openly. Number four, self-esteem. A psychiatrist friend once told me that if a person has a healthy dose of self-esteem, they will go through life with more ease and less angst. My mother was a perfect example. She knew who she was, what her purpose was in life, and set about making a happy life for herself and her family. She raised two children who were as different as day and night, yet she gave both of us a sense that we were each just perfect being who we were. In her very quiet way, she supported and nurtured my individuality, making me feel secure and enthusiastic about my feelings, opinions, and interests. This attribute of my mother's has served me well. Number five, independence. During an era when women were often locked into the conventional role as homemaker, my mother was busy getting a teaching degree, taking art classes, planning short trips with girlfriends, and generally living a life with lots of independence and freedom. She pursued her interests joyously while still running a household, cooking meals, and participating in an active social life with her husband and her family. This independence came crashing down when she became sick, and I am sure it was devastating for someone so independent to become so diminished. When it came time for me to go away to college, my mother was having a recurrence of her cancer. I sat with her and asked her if I should defer starting school to stay home and care for her. She looked at me and said, "Absolutely not. This is my life, and yours is out there waiting for you. You must go." Her independent spirit knew no other way. And it was this self-permission that allowed me to go without guilt or regret. So I hope to honor and embrace these five attributes my mother exhibited so effortlessly in her short lifetime and celebrate the gifts she gave to me. This is Dr. Sharon Ufberg on 51%.
Ufberg is co-founder of the personal development wellness company Borrowed Wisdom in California. She writes for the Huffington Post and Thrive Global. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. The show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1452.